Hello, and welcome to the Inside Social Work podcast, where we take a peek behind the scenes into different fields of social work, engage and inspire practitioners, translate research into practice, and encourage lifelong learning. I'm your host, Marie Vakakis. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed today's podcast episode. Hello, I hope you're doing well. In this week's episode, I invite Dr. Rosemary Higgins onto the show. Rosemary is not a social worker, she's a psychologist. And the reason I had her on the show is she's very experienced in delivering a particular type of technique called motivational interviewing. Rosemary goes across the country training allied health professionals, nurses, GPs, in motivational interviewing techniques to help support their patients or clients with behavior change. Her interest in particular on her specialty area is working with chronic health conditions, in particular heart conditions and heart health. In this episode, Rosemary shares a little bit about the basics of motivational interviewing, what it is, how you can use it, and then some of the resources that you can find to learn a bit more about motivational interviewing and to learn a bit more about cardiac health. So if you work with patients who have heart conditions or you work with families of people who have heart conditions and chronic health conditions in general, some of the training she delivers and some of the available, training options on the Heart Health website might be useful to you. So you can check out the show notes for some information on those. I hope you enjoy my interview with Rosemary Higgins looking at motivational interviewing. Okay, welcome to the podcast, Dr. Rosemary Higgins. Hello.
Hello, Marie.
So your title, you've got a few titles. We've got the clinical side, so the Rosemary Higgins bit. Dr. Rosemary Higgins is academic and honorary associate professor. Have I left anything out?
Mm-hmm. At Deakin.
At Deakin.
Just the senior, honorary senior
researcher. Honorary senior researcher. So you've got a wealth of experience both in the academic and research side and clinical side of psychology.
Yeah, it makes me a bit of a rare beast, really. Across both fields, I've always worked in research 2-3 days a week and clinical practice 2-3 days a week. They flex up and flex down. Love working on projects, love working, training people, love working face-to-face with one-on-one with help with clients, and love working with groups. So I get all my needs met.
And you're not a social worker, so we'll just put that out there. But I wanted to have you on the podcast because you're one of the people that help train allied health staff in various, therapeutic techniques. And one of them, which we want to talk about today, is motivational interviewing.
Mm-hmm.
So for those listeners who are new to the field, could you explain a little bit about what is motivational interviewing?
It's a technique that arose in drug and alcohol counselling. And it's based on the evidence that relationship actually helps to drive change. It's not bossing people around. It's not telling people what to do. It's actually just connecting with people and helping them to connect with their will to change. So motivational interviewing at its very essence is a connection with the part of the person that wants to change and helping them to hear themselves and hear that little voice within themselves that wants different. So that's where it started. My work in it is using motivational interviewing with patients with a chronic disease. So people with heart disease primarily, but also with a range of other chronic illnesses. So it's a way of being with people. And that's the challenge to learn. It's not a book of rules. It's not this. It's a position. It's a collaborative, patient-centered, curious, empathic, exploratory challenging partnership position. It's a great way of working, and it can bring out people can find the best in themselves that they didn't even know was there. And it's fun. I've taught this to a lot of Aboriginal health workers around the country. We did a lot of training of Aboriginal health workers between 2004 and 2008 or 9, and they were really enjoying using it for themselves. And I've taught this to GPs and practice nurses, and even had them all together in the same training groups, and they were informing each other of their practice and really helping each other to get the best at this.
So it's a tool to support behaviour change.
Tool to support behaviour change, and it's very basic. Yeah.
Okay, so you said GPs can use it. So I imagine it can be incorporated in brief work with someone. So GPs, we know, traditionally are very pressed for time and only see patients for small, you know, 5-10 minute blocks. How do they use it in those small sessions?
Same as physios as well. This is a real challenge for people using this sort of approach in a short amount of time. What I think it comes down to is the first essence of motivation interviewing is not to build resistance. In no way to increase the person's resistance to change. And if that's all you do, you have done an intervention. So not increasing resistance, vital. Connecting, vital. Inquiring with empathy about the person's reasons for changing and not changing. It's really using your time well, whether you've got 5 minutes or 50 minutes. It's using your time well to connect, to be curious, to open yourself up, and to be ready to listen to what's going on within the person and to help them to hear their what we call change talk. So it's the change talk that you listen for, and it's the change talk that you amplify. As you hear the change talk, I might, I could, I wish, I want, I sometimes dream about, if only, a little bit of me wants. That's the stuff that you're really interested in. That's the stuff you want to hear more of. And you listen in for that. So it's a way of working with someone where you really tune in to that part of them that wants to change. But you have to do that in a way. They have to trust you in order for that part to come out. Has to be a collaborative experience, and that's, I suppose, the GPs can do that in terms of being very aware of the power dynamic of that relationship.
Mm. So let's say you got as a practitioner or an intake referral saying someone's coming to see you to change their relationship with alcohol,
mm-hmm.
and they sit down. Could you give me an example of a type of question you might ask that actually builds resistance and a type of question you would ask that is more of the motivational interviewing type and how that can be a little bit more gentle? So could I be your pretend patient and you just throw that at me?
Yeah. I'm not sure I'm very good at building resistance. Oh, you should have come 20 years ago. Yeah. How come you've come now, not 20 years ago? You've really stuffed your life up, really. That would build resistance, wouldn't it?
Or defeat, yeah. Defeat. Hopelessness, yeah.
Hopelessness. So you wouldn't do that?
No. So that's what not to do for the listeners.
Don't do that. I don't think anybody would do that.
I think, you know, we all get triggered, I guess, with our judgments and even micro expressions and what we say. It can have an impact.
Maybe that's what sometimes people are thinking, even if they don't say it, and it does have an impact, yeah.
Okay, so how could you say that in a more motivation, an MI type of way?
So if you came to me and said that I'm a bit worried about my relationship with alcohol, is that what you were saying? Or?
Yeah, that's on the intake form. That's kind of what I decided to do.
Yeah, that's interesting, maybe. And is that something that's been a concern to you, or not so much of a concern?
Seems to be more of a concern for others, so I don't see it as such a problem.
Yeah, so they've been telling you stuff that they're worried about your stuff, are they?
Yeah, I've been getting some ultimatums from people, and I don't get what the big deal is, really.
That sounds pretty tough.
Oh, it's their problem. I'm a hoot.
Yeah, and yet you're here.
Yeah.
So the bit of you brought you here, even though you think it's you're a hoot and you think it's their problem, there's a little bit of you that brought you here. And
Ooh, very good, Rosemary. Okay, so we can see
so,
the difference. I couldn't keep role playing because I'm like, this isn't true for me, so I'm not sure where to take it. But okay, so we're sitting with that ambivalence.
yeah, but just with the gentleness, I think, because it's really, really scary to go and see someone about your alcohol problem, your drug problem, the fact that, you're unhealthy or you want to change your lifestyle or whatever. It's pretty scary. It's confronting. And there's a lot of stigma out there.
Yeah. What are some of the challenges, I guess allied health professionals face when trying to implement this strategy? So, as you're teaching them in the courses that you deliver in the training programs, what do you hear from participants about being, this is a new way of talking for some, not for all. What are they finding really difficult about using this technique?
I know, I've probably taught over 4,000 health professionals across Australia and workshops in international conferences. So I've taught a lot of people, and we've actually developed an online course based on my teaching as well to make it easier as well. Basically, it's very de-skilling. It's the thought is, if I don't tell people what to do, then how will they know what to do? I won't be doing my job if I don't tell them what to do. I usually try with that in those courses to work with the resistance. So there'll be resistance within the course, and the resistance is normal because I'm exposing people to a different part of practice, a different way of working. And so, same as in motivational interviewing, we don't increase resistance in that sort of work. We try not to increase resistance. So I encourage them to just think of it as an extra tool. I think of it as something, get them to ask permission if they want to give suggestions. So one of the things that people struggle with is not giving suggestions as to how to change. And so in order for people to manage that, in the courses I do a very immersive experience where people work on their own behaviour change. And when they work with each other, and I encourage them to do a 5-minute block where they listen but don't give any suggestions, just a very basic listening technique. And the listeners find it incredibly difficult not to give in suggestions. But the people who are heard, and we hear from them first, talk about the journey of change that they've been on in even 5 minutes. And that's such a powerful moment for the listeners to understand that they can be effective when they're not making suggestions, just they're listening. Yeah, all of this work builds on our big randomized controlled trial, because I know you're interested in the basics of how and what to do, but I'm always interested in the evidence behind it. So if you don't mind, can we briefly talk about the randomized controlled trial that we set up to?
Sure. Could I ask one quick question before we touch on the randomized control trial?
Yeah.
It sounds like the difficulty the therapists or clinicians have is giving space for someone to discuss the pros and the cons for their behavior. So I've seen that in when I've done my training. People really don't want to say, so what are the good things about drinking? And if we don't acknowledge what purpose it's serving or give someone that space.
I do this as a exercise. I've done this as exercise in groups quite a lot. It's a lovely exercise to do, and I do it with when I'm teaching this at the universities. And quite often we focus on drinking behaviour with the health professionals. Sometimes we're focusing on work-life balance, especially for those that don't stop work at the right time and work through their lunch break, and it's many of our nursing staff. So, and what I talk about them is that what happens is if you are saying to the person all of the good things about change, and they are telling you all of the bad things about change. So, in response to everything you say, they will say, yes, but. If I say to you, alcohol will rot your liver, you will say, yes, but I enjoy it. I say, alcohol, will make you more likely to end up in the emergency department. Yes, but it's how I help myself to unwind. So that's the yes buts. So every time you get a yes, but, I ask people to sit back from that and to know that you are taking one side of the argument, and then the patient has to take the other side. And what we want is for that argument to be going on inside the patient's head, inside their head, not between you and the patient. This is an argument that goes on internally. So when we use what we call the decisional balance, the pros and cons, the good and bad, and I just use it very simply. I'll just use it, the good and the not so good things. And I always start on the not so good, because if you don't, you'll get yes, but. So we start on the not so good. So not so good things about giving up alcohol. I love it. It's fun. Tastes good. I've got a great big wine collection. It makes me fun. I don't know what I'll do otherwise. There's a 20, 30, 40 things they'll get to. That's great. And we keep on going, we keep on going, we keep on going. And clinicians at first feel uncomfortable. But as we go through the process, sometimes it's only through going through the process that you learn how valuable the process is. So I help have them to hold their doubt. And then we go to the other side. And we don't go to the other side until the person or the group is ready. We know it's time to go to the other side, the good things about change, because people are starting to come up with those ideas. We're not pushing the transition from the not so good to the good. The people who we are talking to are. So that's one of the arts of moving from the not so good to the good. So when we're moving from the not so good to the good, we'll hear it in the audience. Oh, yeah, but sometimes I, really embarrassed, once I piss my pants, that sort of stuff. And so when it's that moment, then you say, okay, well, not so good things. Let's good things about giving up alcohol. And the person, there will be no yes buts, because you've got them all out of the way. All of them are already said. So that means that they're not going to get in the way, and the person will be able to talk. And what we're really looking for in the good things is the identity stuff. Is the deepest personal core, is the values, is that I don't like myself when I drink, is that I want to be a better parent. And the other thing, when we're doing with this with chronic health behaviors, I want to live longer. I'm going to die earlier. I don't, I'm going to get more, and I won't be there to walk my daughter down the aisle. I won't see my granddaughter. Own children being born, I won't be able to help my children. I won't grow old with my partner. Those really, really, this will be the last dog I'll ever have. those really personal projects that will be upset by that behaviour. And then when we finish that project, we've got all the barriers. The not so good things about giving up alcohol, that helps us with all the barrier planning. So the health professionals, through actually doing this process, and if they, I get them to do it for themselves with their own behaviour change, they start to see their own barriers. The problem, some people think that it's maths. They think if you get 10 not so good and 20 good things, then necessarily, job's done. It's more reflection. So this, the basis of this is getting people to reflect. Where does that leave you? We want the ambivalence, the cognitive dissonance about holding two very different thoughts in mind at the same time, to sit within the person in an uncomfortable place, because that is what is going to drive change. Nothing else. That discomfort is going to drive change, and that's what we're trying to harness.
So before we go into your research and the randomized control trial, just briefly, are there, what areas, where can this be used? So you've mentioned it started off in the alcohol and drug sector.
I've been in cardiac rehabilitation, so I've been training lots and lots of people who work in cardiac rehabilitation, with spiritual rehabilitation, chronic disease management. In terms of education, I get people when we're setting up education to actually explore the not so good, the good. Part of this is making sure that you set goals. If you thought of the goals that people feel confident about and that are important, quite often we'll set goals with people that aren't important, but they might feel confident, or that they don't feel confident about and that are very important. We set people up to fail. So I think most where we're doing generalised any goal setting interventions, we really have to be thinking around this introducing a motivational interviewing component to help us to really know where, how to set these goals, how to set these goals, and how to be responsive and make it behavioural goal setting, but collaborative goal setting. So any goal setting, any chronic disease management program. So that's where I'm focused on, which is health, behaviour change, community programs, hospital programs, and that sort of support.
Okay. So what I'm hearing in that is also, well, it sounds like it can be used anywhere where you're trying to support someone to do something different. So it could be everything from healthcare, mental health, relationship work. It's across the board.
Yeah. And I think it's not supporting someone. I think it's working with someone, because it's a more collaborative, it's a guiding relationship. Mm. It's not a leading and it's not a following. It's guiding. And shining a light with them into themselves and helping them to understand.
Some criticism of the technique is that it can be a little bit manipulative. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think it could be used in a manipulative way. So I think we're all really, when we've got all of our techniques that we have, are really, you know, that means that we've got these high-level skills, these powers, there's this knowledge and these strategies that could be used and manipulation. They're used for sales, they're used for advertising. Everything we do to help create change is actually used to make money in the marketing and sales world. So, you know, this is my, you know, when I'm working with smokers, I'm really aware that I'm working against an industry that's producing 3 trillion cigarettes a year. that's killing multiple smokers, that's taking 10 years off people's lives, that's taking people away from their families. So I'm really aware of the importance of that, and really aware that, you know, that this is an area where it's so important. But yeah, it all of our techniques are used to manipulate people. You've got to be aware of that. When you think of in marketing, that emotional appeal, that's the number one appeal. That's the fast brain. So I suppose it's something for all of us to be aware of. What are our values? If you want it more than the person, yeah, that's manipulative. You can't want it more than the person. You got your life. You can go and want things to change in your own life. You've got to be realistic about the edges of, you know, your responsibility. People have autonomy. They can choose to drink. They can choose to self-harm themselves. They can choose to keep smoking. They can choose to be what they call non-compliant with medications. People can choose all of that. They have the right. You've got to respect that. So I suppose if you're coming from a point of view of respect, no. So search your own values. See what a control freak you are. See whether you want to control the lives of others.
It's interesting. Tell us about the Brandema control trial that you were a part of.
Yeah, well, we delivered. So my role was, I write interventions, so I love writing interventions because I speak normal language, rather so I can translate ideas into just regular speech. So I wrote with a colleague, wrote the intervention Beating Heart Problems, and we delivered it to 275. We had a RCT of 275 consecutively admitted patients. So in a randomized controlled trial, put half into the intervention and half into the control group. So half of them were randomized into our group, where we had 8 sessions of motivational interviewing / CBT intervention. What we found is, the really lovely thing we found is reduction in 2-year risk of a cardiac event, which is pretty damn good, really. And also reduced depression symptoms, increased confidence in managing depression, increased confidence in managing anger, trends for improved anxiety, improve physical fitness, blah, 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 blah. So we got lots of really good results. And this was at 4 months and 12 months. So that intervention called the Beating Heart Program, we actually, part of my work is to translate that sort of stuff into usual care. So I like going from an intervention and then going into usual care. So hence, we have delivered the training program, training people around Australia and New Zealand in all the techniques. We've converted it into an online program called the Back on Track program that's freely available. If anybody has any cardiac patients out there who want a free online behavior change program, people who've had heart disease, go to Back on Track, which is at the Australian Centre for Heart Health. We've also translated into a telephone delivery, service delivery program called TeleHeart, and people are very welcome to refer their patients to a 5-module telephone program, which is absolutely free as well. So we've also working at getting some of these parts of this program into cardiac rehab. So we've got it in all different ways as integrating into practice, which I'm pretty pleased with. We've probably trained, you know, with the online and the face-to-face, around 10,000 health professionals in this. We've probably had We're just taking off. We've just had the Back on Track program funded, so it's taking off. It's so we're really excited about this. This is a great. So welcome to come along to the Australian Centre for Heart Health website. Check out our Back on Track program. Check out our TeleHeart program. We've also got a bulk billing clinic as well for expert clinic for people with suffering with some of the psychological issues associated with heart disease.
So what are some of the behaviour changes that people are trying to do with a heart condition? I mean, I would think there'd be a lot. There's been, I mean, in my observation of physical health and emotional and psychological well-being, they used to be quite separate. So people would go to their specialist, be told, take this pill, do this, and done. But I feel like that's being integrated more and more now into the person's emotional connection, lifestyle changes, all these other areas. What are some of the behaviours your program is aiming at changing?
Well, some of the most important behaviours, and this is for everyone, the most important thing anyone can do is actually, understand and take some of the basic medications. We know that the medications will reduce the risk of people dying within a year, within 5 years, within 10 years. Second most, so that's big bang for your buck, taking meds. Sorry about that, because some people won't want to. And so that's a lot of the beating heart problems was around looking at people's attitudes towards medication and trying to boost, address some of the resistances there around medication. So that's a big one. Smoking cessation, really, really important. And what we know generally is after a cardiac event. A cardiac event's very motivating to give up smoking. Lots of people try to give up smoking, but only 50% of people stop smoking after a cardiac event. And of them, around 50% take it back up. So basically, after a cardiac event, we've got 75% of people still smoking. So that's pretty scary, because they're a lot more likely. That's one of the major risk factors for early death for another event. People, if you've had one event, unfortunately more vulnerable to having a second, but they will be a lot better managed and they can do a lot. The third thing is regular physical activity. And that's not marathon running, it's not jogging, it's nothing like that. It's just meeting the physical activity guidelines. It's half an hour, five times a week of walking, and two times a week of strength training, half an hour. It's something people can do, and it's something we can support people to do. There's some evidence around sitting, around avoiding prolonged sitting time. There's reduction in saturated fat consumption, which is really important. We know that depression is associated with cardiac disease. It's a risk factor for cardiac disease. There's not the strong evidence yet that treating depression is effective, but we know that we can help people improve their quality of life with that. Sleep's a really important thing to get right after a cardiac event, and people may need a lot of support with that. There's so much behaviour change, social support and social isolation. People who are socially isolated or lack social support are much more vulnerable. So we want to decrease social isolation, which is one of the modules in the TeleHeart or the Back on Track. We want to increase social support. We want to reduce depression. We want to address what we call the cardiac blues, which is a normal emotional response to a cardiac event. When people become aware of death and mortality, they become overwhelmed by that. That's not necessarily depression. It's just an adjustment response. So there's so much. If people are interested, they can contact the centre and have a little look around. they want to do that before referring their patients.
So I'm curious to see how you marry motivational interviewing with CBT. So could you give just a brief, really brief kind of explanation on how those two techniques fit together?
Well, not fit, but sit side by side. We use a lot of storytelling. So in the groups, the CBT, and in the back on track, the CBT is all through storytelling. It's all people love, and there's a lot of evidence of the power of story. People love to hear about other people like me. So I wrote a lot of little vignettes, and they had old thought, new thought. You know, I don't want to, my medicine, having all this medicine makes me old. I feel old when I look at all the medicine. And then the new thought is, this medicine will help me get old. So that sort of thing. So it's sort of helping people to sort of challenge their thinking, but in a gentle way, and using examples of others. So we had little story case, with a little picture, old way of thinking, old behavior, new way of thinking, new behavior. And in the groups, they were really prompted so much discussion, these stories around. So it's a really gentle way of introducing these CBT concepts. We didn't do an ABCDE because our patients, many of our clients, you know, we would have lost them. But old thought, new thought, yeah. That worked for them. So really getting there and having the concepts accessible and understandable, and speaking the concepts first through other people's language rather than feeling, especially in a group, so personally exposed. So that's how we use them. And we use them as the barriers. Many people, when they're exercising, they may feel a bit of aversion to feeling short of breath. When they feel short of breath, it may remind them of their heart event. And so they'll do some avoidance. They'll feel some anxiety, they'll do some avoidance. So the thinking is, I'm short of breath, I'm going to die, you know. This is like my heart event. And so that's the old thought. And the new thought is, it's normal to be short of breath because I'm pushing myself a little bit. I'm just going to make sure that there's no pain, and I'm going to keep on going, and I'll have a rest. But I'm starting to learn how to trust my body, and I'm a bit healthier than I was before the heart event. So that sort of ways of using storytelling to really bring these thoughts in.
Excellent. Thank you. So where can people find out?
It's okay. They were fun.
You said there's an online course, motivational interviewing course. Where can people find that?
Yeah, that's on the Australian Centre for Heart Health website.
Great, and I'll put a link to that in the notes.
It's called Supporting Chronic Disease Self-Management.
Yep.
So it's 5 modules. It's got behavioural goal setting, motivational interviewing, CBT.
And that's for clinicians to learn. Yeah,
clinicians to Beautiful. Learn. Yeah.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Rosemary.
That's okay. That was fun.
For listening to today's podcast, be sure to check out the show notes for today's episode's resources, and don't forget to click subscribe and review us wherever it is you get your podcasts.